Now I'm going to talk about a number of highlights from the Diamond Sutra, or the Vajra Chedika Prajnaparamita, which is probably the next most popular text of the Perfection of Wisdom discourses. The Vajra Chedika, or the Diamond Sutra, has been very, very widely studied, and is very, very widely respected throughout the Mahayana world. It has also quite a close connection with the Chan and Zen traditions. You may have heard the story of the sixth patriarch, Wei Neng, who one day heard someone reciting the Diamond Sutra in the street, and as a result of that he decided to go to the monastery and where, because he, according to legend, was illiterate, he was given a job pounding rice. And then after some time the call for the succession to the patriarchal robe came, and there was that exchange of verses between Xunshu and Wei Neng. Wei Neng was eventually selected as a successor. Anyway, it was the hearing of the Diamond Sutra, the Vajra Chedika, which started all of that. So this is a text that has enjoyed a great deal of popularity and a great deal of prominence. Now the text, if anything, is probably more difficult than the Heart Sutra, and more difficult than the Prajnaparamita, the Ashtashastrika Prajnaparamita. It's a text which makes extensive use of paradox, and that's why I've begun the outline of the lecture by referring to the pedagogy of paradox. A pedagogy, of course, is a teaching method, is a method of teaching. So the sutra teaches, the teaching of the sutra is conveyed by means of paradox. And this is typical of the style and the contents of the sutra. So it begins, or doesn't exactly begin, but the first point that I want to draw your attention to is in section 3. And in section 3, the sutra talks about the real practice of the Mahayana. And it says that the real practice of the Mahayana is to liberate all living beings without exception. Whatever living beings there are, the objective of the Mahayana is to liberate all of them. The objective of the Bodhisattva is to liberate all living beings without exception. But in reality, as a matter of fact, no living being whatsoever is ever liberated. Now, right here, you have, for people who want to think in ordinary terms, this is a blatant contradiction. It's a paradox. The objective of the Bodhisattva is to liberate all living beings, but at the same time he knows that no living being whatsoever is ever liberated. All right? Now I'm just going to leave it at that for the moment. I'm not going to explain that. I think some of you will be able to guess the solution to this. But similarly, with regard to the practice of generosity, etc., the sutra says the person, the Bodhisattva, should practice the perfection of generosity, should practice generosity, etc., without attachment. And this is what I was talking about a moment ago, that when you practice generosity, you practice it without attachment to the idea of the giver, without attachment to the gift, without attachment to the recipient, without attachment to the action of giving. And if you practice generosity in this way, without attachment, then you will acquire limitless merit. The merit will become immeasurable. You see, because what will occur is that the practice of generosity will then become transcendental. It will become a perfection because it's practiced without attachment. It's practiced without notions of the giver, the gift, and the recipient, and so forth. And again, the discourse talks about the raft and refers to the parable of the raft, how the Dharma is like a raft and the Dharma should not be held onto. This is the same example, the same analogy that we encountered in the Alagotamama Sutta, where it talked about the Dharma as like a raft. Now the Diamond Sutra goes on to say that there is in fact no Dharma, there's no teaching. And why is there no Dharma? Why is there no teaching? Because truth is inexpressible. Truth is beyond words and beyond thought. It's inconceivable. The ultimate truth, the way things really are, is inexpressible. Therefore, there's no Dharma and no teaching. And in this same vein, in the Mula Madhyamaka Karika, Nagarjuna says, the Buddha never taught any Dharma to anyone anywhere. You know? So from the ultimate point of view, and this is of course the text is, again, the purpose of this text is to demonstrate the ultimate point of view, the ultimate standpoint, the Paramartha Satya, the looking at things from the standpoint of ultimate truth. So there is no teaching of the Dharma anywhere because the truth is inexpressible. And another point which the sutra makes is with regard to the accumulation of merit. And it talks about how a bodhisattva might accumulate merit. This is an interesting quality, an interesting aspect of the text, that it introduces, it begins to talk about the merit that is acquired by listening to this text, reciting this text, memorizing this text, passing this text on to other people, and it compares the merit that one might acquire by making incalculable gifts to incalculable living beings, and how that merit is as nothing compared to the merit that one will gain simply by memorizing, by listening to, memorizing, and transmitting a few lines of this text, the Vajracchedika. So here we begin to see, and this is something which is quite common in the Mahayana, and this is perhaps something which is a new development. I don't know whether you have this idea in the Pali tradition. I'd be interested to hear from some of you who are more conversant than I am with the Pali tradition, whether you have a parallel conception in the Theravada tradition. But in the Mahayana tradition, there is this notion that of the sacred or the merit to be acquired by remembering, reciting, retaining, transmitting texts and transmitting teachings. And at many places it says with regard to the Diamond Sutra and with regard to other Mahayana sutras that the merit of memorizing and retaining and transmitting these texts is far greater than the merit that you can acquire by practicing generosity or doing other good works. So there's a kind of exaltation or kind of raising of the of the importance of the text to a point at which the mere memorization and transmission of a text is worth much more merit than ordinary good works such as giving and the like. And then the text goes on to talk about the four Arya Pudgala, the four holy personalities, according to the Theravada tradition, the Sotapanna, the stream winner, and so forth. And it says that the Sotapanna, the stream winner, and so forth, that they're only names, that these stages are only names, that they don't have any real significance. But why is it that they have no real significance? They have no real significance because there is no ego. There's no conception of I. So insofar as there's no conception of I, how could you have a conception of a stream winner and so forth? How could you have a conception of an Arya Pudgala? And in fact, this is something which has always appeared to me also to be something of a contradiction. We're talking about now already at the point of stream entry, one has given up attachment to the self. And yet we refer to these persons as Arya Pudgala, as holy or noble persons. So here the text says these are only names because in fact at the point of stream entry and so forth, there's no more ego, there's no more attachment to I and mine. And the text then goes on to talk about how there is no going, no coming, and no staying. So again, this is from the point of view of ultimate truth. Nothing comes into being, nothing goes out of being, nothing remains, nothing stays. It is an indirect reference again to the three characteristics of conditioned things: origination, duration, and destruction, coming into being, remaining in being, lasting in time, and going out of being or destruction. The text also refers to mind, and it talks about how there is no mind, there is no past mind, no present mind, and no future mind. The whole text, the whole Diamond Sutra, is a string of negations, a string of denials. There is, just as in the Heart Sutra, you see, in emptiness there is no form, no feeling, etc. Here, there is no mind, no past mind, no present mind, no future mind. None of these can be grasped. And this, of course, reminds one of the story that is told of one of the Chan masters. A disciple came to one of the Chan masters and said to him, "My mind is distressed. My mind is not at ease. Please, master, can you pacify my mind?" And the master said, "Show me your mind and I'll pacify it for you." And of course the disciple was unable to show him his mind, and so he realized that he had no, that there was no mind. And so there was nothing to pacify him, so his mind was pacified. And of course this idea of no mind is something which is a very integral part of the Mahayana tradition, that mind also ultimately does not really exist. And we'll be talking a little bit about this afternoon when we look at the Lankavatara Sutra, because the Lankavatara Sutra is of course well known for teaching the doctrine that everything is created by mind. But then when we turn and look for mind itself, we don't find mind, we can't locate mind. This is also one of the practices that is recommended in the Perfection of Wisdom discourses, to look for our mind, to look for one's own mind. So when we look for one's own mind, is it round, is it square, is it short, is it long, is it outside, is it inside? Where can we locate our own mind? And then the sutra goes on to speak in paradoxical terms about the attainment. You remember in the Heart Sutra we had the "there's no attainment, there's no non-attainment." Now here in the Diamond Sutra it says that the Buddha, the Buddha's attainment of enlightenment is really no attainment. And that's why it's called the attainment of enlightenment. So because it's really no attainment, it's called the attainment of enlightenment. And similarly, the accumulation of great merit is really no merit. That's why it's called great merit. You see? So it's really no merit, that's why it's called great merit. Now, what does this mean? It is no merit because of the emptiness of the person who accumulates the merit, the emptiness of the merit accumulated, and so forth. But for the same reason, it's great merit because it is merit which is not material. It's transcendental merit. So no merit equals great merit because it's non-material. It's not objectified. The whole message of the text is not to objectify things, not to turn things into objects, not to turn things into things that you can hold on to. And then the text goes on to talk about perceiving of the Buddha, and this is one of the most important and most famous passages in the whole sutra. And again, we are taken back to our discussion that we had in the beginning of the course about the equivalence of the Buddha and Dharma, and how really seeing the Buddha implies really seeing the Dharma, that he who sees the Dharma sees the Buddha, that he who sees the Buddha in his physical form does not really see the Buddha. And this is said very clearly in the Diamond Sutra, and it says the Buddha is not perceived by means of his 32 marks. If you were to perceive the Buddha by means of the 32 marks, then the Buddha would be indistinguishable from any universal monarch, because you know that the universal monarchs also, according to Buddhist tradition, are believed to possess 32 special marks, which are the same marks that the Buddha possesses. But the Buddha cannot be perceived by means of the 32 marks. And it goes on to say, whoever sees the Buddha by form or seeks the Buddha in sound, he is mistaken. His footsteps upon the path are perverted because he will never see the Buddha. So again, the idea that perceiving the Buddha by means of his physical form or by means of his voice, that this is not really perceiving the Buddha, that really perceiving the Buddha is perceiving the Dharma, perceiving the transcendental dimension of Buddhahood, not the physical dimension, which is only a worldly manifestation. And then it continues to talk about the Buddha to reinforce the idea of the transcendental nature of the Buddha, or the untraceable or unfathomable nature of the Buddha. And it says, he neither comes nor goes. The Buddha neither comes nor goes. And because the Buddha has neither this side nor that side, he has neither this side or that side. He's neither here nor there. So the Buddha is, again, cannot be pinned down. You cannot fix the Buddha in time and space. So the text talks about all of these conventional descriptions of merit of the Buddha, these conventional notions of how we perceive the Buddha and so forth, and it rejects all these conventional forms. It says also that the world, that the cosmos and so forth are only words, that these words are fit for common people, fit for the man in the street, fit for the ignorant, not fit for the enlightened or intelligent seeker after truth. Because the truth is beyond all words, the truth is beyond all expression. So the final message of the sutta, is to give up conventional truth, to abandon conventional truth, to abandon all conceptions like those of personality, like those of factors, and so forth. all conventional truth is invalidated. The only truth is ultimate truth. And all things, and again here we have a list of similes, all things are fleeting. All things are like a star in the morning. All things are like a fault of vision. This is another example that's commonly used, the example of a fault of vision. It was the case that certain defects of vision produced the images of hair and so forth in front of the eyes. So the whole phenomenal world is like a fault of vision. It's like a dream. It's the purpose of the sutra is to demonstrate the ultimate truth, and it demonstrates the ultimate truth through juxtaposing, through highlighting the opposition between conventional truth and ultimate truth. Liberating all living beings is the object of the bodhisattva, but the real bodhisattva knows that no living being is ever liberated. And why is that? Because no living being really exists. In ultimate truth, there is no really existing living being, because there is no I and there is no mind. Similarly, great merit is no merit, because there is ultimately the only merit that is great merit is merit which takes into account the emptiness, the non-existence of the I and the object and so on. So from the point of view of ultimate truth, all of these conventional usages, the acquisition of merit, the bodhisattva vow to liberate all living beings, from the point of view of ultimate truth, all of this is non-existent, all of this is empty. The idea here is, again, it is not to, you know, I think I need to make a particular point of the fact that the conventional truth and the ultimate truth don't contradict each other. The conventional truth and the ultimate truth don't contradict each other because they, so to speak, have different purposes. They operate at different levels. They reflect different points of view. Nagarjuna said, without relying on the conventional truth, the ultimate truth is not taught. Without arriving at the ultimate truth, liberation is not gained. So we rely upon the conventional truth to teach the ultimate truth. We encourage people to realize the ultimate truth so that they may gain liberation. So the conventional truth and the ultimate truth go together. They are stages, they are levels of perception. So that the transition from conventional truth to ultimate truth is a transition in our way of perceiving things. At another place, Nagarjuna says that if you take the world as cause and condition, as dependent, then you experience samsara. If you take reality, if you take what is given, the real, whatever is presented to us, if we take it as conditioned and dependent, then it is samsara. If we take it as non-conditioned and non-dependent, then it is nirvana. So it depends on how we perceive the world, how we take the world. If we take the world in one way, then it is bondage, it is suffering, it is samsara. We take the world in another way, it's bliss, it's nirvana, it's freedom. So this transition from samsara to nirvana is a subjective transition. It's something that takes place within the perceiving subject, within each and every one of us, and it depends upon how we view reality. It's not a physical movement. It's not a material change. It's not a change of address. It's not moving from one province to another, from one land to another, from one world to another. It's a change that takes place within our minds, having to do with the way in which we perceive reality. So the acquisition, the attainment, the gaining of nirvana is a mental acquisition. It's a mental achievement, something that happens subjectively within our own minds. That's why the Buddha also couldn't say whether the world had a beginning or not, whether the world had a limit or not, because the beginning and the end of the world depend on the subject. They don't depend on anything external. They don't depend on an objective, independent reality. They're mind-dependent. Whether the world exists or does not depends upon our perceptions. So this is the point that the Prajnaparamita literature attempts to make through the negation of all the conventional forms with which we are familiar. What it is doing is it is beginning to pry us loose from the raft, and its purpose in doing that is so that we don't remain attached to even the Dharma. In the parable of the raft, the Buddha says one should give up the Dharma, let alone non-Dharma. So first, living beings are taught to give up unwholesome attitudes, to give up evil inclinations and unwholesome actions. Later, when they're well established on the path, when they practice virtue, when they understand wholesome actions, at that point they need to be taught not to hold on to these wholesome actions, to be able to relinquish them, to be able to give them up so that they can attain freedom. So we have a progressive movement here from ignorance, bondage, to virtue, to happier conditions. But eventually, if we want to attain freedom, if we want to attain enlightenment, we have to go beyond even virtue and fortunate rebirths and good conditions. This is the difference between the two goals that Buddhism teaches. Buddhism offers a provisional goal and it offers a final goal. And the provisional goal, of course, is Abhyudaya. It's heaven, fortunate rebirths, good circumstances. And the final goal is Nishrayasa, liberation, unbinding, freedom. And all the Dharma that we might practice, all the virtues that we might practice, will only lead us to happiness and prosperity. If we want to gain ultimate enlightenment and freedom, we have to relinquish our conceptions of I and mind. We have to relinquish our attachment to factors and persons. We have to relinquish our attachment to dualistic conceptions of existence, non-existence, permanence, impermanence, self, not self, happiness, suffering, and so forth, one and many, and so forth. We have to relinquish all these dualistic conceptions so that we can attain enlightenment without any residue, without any leftover shadow of a conception or a negation of a conception or an object or a negation of an object and the like. We have to achieve complete openness without any mental support, without any support, without any objective support, without relying upon any form, any sound, or any mental object. Liberation when the mind is unbound, when the mind is freed from relying upon any objective support. So that the liberation that we attain in that case is a realization, is an enlightenment that is truly supreme and beyond all limitations, beyond all conditions. So this is the message of the Perfection of Wisdom Sutras. It opens up a wide panorama. It opens up a wide stage, a great theater in which it is possible to attain Buddhahood. It opens up our it dissolves the limitations that keep us imprisoned in samsara, and it allows us to develop that kind of enlightened mind, which is similar to the enlightened mind of the Buddha. There will be considerable degree of discussion about this in the Lankavatara and other discourses, and we will look at the whole process of how we turn bondage and suffering and the experience of an ordinary living being into the experience of an enlightened one. There'll be quite a lot of detailed discussion of this in the we'll begin to see it in the Lankavatara, and then we will see it in greater detail in the texts of the schools, the Madhyamaka and the Yogacara schools, the major schools of the Mahayana. But for the time being, the perfection of wisdom has achieved its objective. Its objective is to sweep away all those preconceptions, to sweep away all those quote-unquote truths with a small t that we have been used to relying upon as practitioners. Perfection of wisdom is not for non-practitioners. Perfection of wisdom is not for non-Buddhists. The perfection of wisdom is not for those who haven't begun to tread the path. The perfection of wisdom is for those who are treading the path, who understand virtue, who understand unwholesome actions, who understand karma, understand rebirth, and who understand the desirability of achieving a higher and a purer state of being. Perfection of wisdom is for those people, and it's meant to open them up, to make them ready to become Buddhas, to make them ready to abandon all conceptions, to make them ready to give up the raft when they've crossed the river. That is what the perfection of wisdom is all about. Okay, what shall we do? Questions or excerpts? Or I don't know. How much time have we got left?
Is it 10 minutes?
Would you like to ask questions, or would you like to hear some readings from the Perfection of Wisdom discourses?
Any questions?
I see the list that you have distributed.
No, those questions we will keep in.
No, those questions we will discuss on Saturday, because they are examples of questions that will appear or may very well appear in the midterm examination and in the final examination.
But for now, if there are any other question on this basis of Prajnaparamita literature or the sutras, anything? Otherwise.
Well, there's about 5 minutes left by my watch, so why don't you just read for them the Heart Sutra? I think you won't have time to do the.
No, here is 10 minutes.
Is it?
Yeah, no, isn't it? 10 minutes? Or what is it? 10 minutes, right?
Well, then read as much as you can of these excerpts. What it means is that if you look for the mind, you can't find it. Now the past mind, of course, it doesn't exist now; it's past. And future mind doesn't exist now because it's yet to appear. But even present mind you can't grasp, because present mind is every second, every.
So you mean past is past, and
Yeah, exactly. I mean, you can't grasp the mind. You can't hold on to any one of these three minds. You certainly can't hold on to past mind because it's already past. You can't hold on to future mind because it hasn't yet come. But even present mind you can't grasp because in the act of grasping it, it becomes past. So it's fleeting. You can't hold on to it. Yes. No. There's really no. In Buddhism we adopt what they call a cardiac theory of consciousness, which means that the seat of consciousness is in the heart, not in the head. In the West, we tend to think of consciousness or mind as being in the head. In Buddhism, we think of consciousness or mind as being in the heart. So actually, you do see translators sometimes opting for heart rather than mind. For example, the first verses of the Dhammapada where it says all phenomena, mind or heart is the forerunner of all things, and all things are made of the heart, made of the mind. So it's an alternative translation. There really isn't any difference in Buddhist terms in the sense that, well, let me put it this way. There is a difference in the sense that the term hridaya, which we would directly and very literally translate heart, refers to the organ. The mind, which is vijnana or citta, the mind resides in the heart. So there is that difference that the mind is the seat. The place of residence in the body where the mind stays is the heart. So you still can have a conception of mind. Only thing is that in Buddhism the mind resides in the heart. So sometimes we can say, you know, that it is the heart that perceives, or the heart that thinks, the heart that is the seat of consciousness. Actually, you will notice this if you do a little experiment. If you can cease, you know, your intellectual activity for a few moments, then you will find that the center of your awareness actually does drop down from your head to your heart. I think this is an experiment that I did many years ago, and I occasionally do. And I think if you can cease thinking, you know, cease discursive thought for even a few seconds, you'll find that instead of having the feeling that you're experiencing the world through your head, you will have the feeling that your awareness, your consciousness is actually in the heart area.
Because yesterday I read a book, a Chinese book. It said because Chinese mind and heart is different meaning. So the book said the mind is the function, is the function of heart. So I got a little confused.
Yeah, I think you should think of it in this sense, that the heart is the seat of the mind. The heart is the place of residence of the mind. So in a sense, the function of the heart is consciousness, is awareness, apart from pumping blood, which of course is the modern conception and is of course also factual. But in terms of consciousness, the heart is the organ which is conscious, let's put it that way. You know, the mind resides, consciousness or mind resides in the heart, according to the Buddhist view. But it's not that the terms are identical; they refer exactly to the same thing. Some translators, as I said, they like to translate mind as heart. I think because of the Western inclination, the Western tendency to identify mind with the head, and so in order to avoid encouraging people to think of mind or consciousness as being based in the head, so they translate mind or consciousness as heart. Actually, the terms are different. Hridaya is a specific term referring to the heart, or sometimes it means essence, but of course those, you know, terms are related. And the terms for consciousness are quite different. Citta, vijnana, manas is another term. There's a lot of terms for consciousness. but they're not exactly the same. It's just that the mind or consciousness resides in the heart. That's its place of residence in the body, not in the head.
Dr. Sadhana, are you trying to say that we should separate the physical heart and brain from the analytical use of mind and heart?
Well, nobody really knows what consciousness is or where it is. I mean, scientists have not been able to pin down consciousness. This is the whole point of this new branch of philosophy called consciousness studies. Where exactly is consciousness? What is consciousness? Is consciousness is it in the brain or is it somewhere else? Some quite prominent scientists, neurologists, have suggested that the brain is like the hardware, the mind is like the software. So even though the brain may appear to perform the functions of perception and so forth, but actually the awareness or consciousness as such does not belong to the brain. This is partly, this explains partly how people can have out-of-body experiences, consciousness, when they are officially brain dead. So this is a very complex question which scientists also are still struggling with. Where exactly does consciousness reside? What exactly is consciousness? So I don't think that we have to worry about separating them, because we can just be content with a Buddhist analysis which places the seat of consciousness in the heart and which has a very detailed description of how consciousness operates and what exactly consciousness is, since we don't have any direct challenge, we don't have any coherent challenge from the scientific or medical community, since they themselves are still working it out.
More question, please. Because I don't have time after it.
Dr. Sadhana.
Yeah.
In the Theravada Sutras, they all start with the just have I heard,
yes,
a location, and to who, and also in the Mahayana Sutras, the same thing does occur in many of the larger sutras.
Yes.
Is there a way by which you can link the two, or like in the early days of your lectures, you used to show us the Mahayana aspect in the Theravada Sutra?
Yes, yes.
If we take the Dhamma Sutra,
yes,
is there any part of the Dhamma Sutra that can be found in the Theravada Sutra, and vice versa?
Well, I mean, there is that close coincidence where in the Theravada text it said that he who sees interdependent origination sees the Dharma, he who sees the Dharma sees the Buddha. And we have this statement in the Diamond Sutra that those who follow me by my, who see me by my form or seek me by my voice, by my sound, that they don't really see the Buddha. So we have some parallels there. There are places in the various sutras where there are some parallels. I don't think we can claim that we have you know great many. In the particularly Mahayana Sutras, I don't think that we have any great body of parallel texts or identical passages and so forth. What we do have, of course, in the Mahayana canon is that we do have versions of, for example, the Dhammacakkappavattana Sutta, and many of these fundamental sutras that we find in the Nikayas, we also find in the Mahayana canon. So it's not so much that we can expect or that we can look for and expect to find many statements and texts like the Prajnaparamita Hridaya Sutra or the Lotus Sutra or the Diamond Sutra, we can't expect to find many passages in those texts that are exactly paralleled in the Theravada texts, because those texts are specifically intended to teach the Mahayana doctrine. And if you notice, in those texts, the audience is very often bodhisattvas, and with a few arhats thrown in. There aren't too many, in many cases, there aren't large assemblies of monks. And they're also delivered, some of them are delivered in a kind of extraterrestrial locale, like the Lankavatara, which we're going to begin to study this afternoon. Lankavatara Sutra is delivered on the top of a mountain in Sri Lanka. Now, historically, we have no documentation that the Buddha ever visited Sri Lanka. But by the same time, by the same token, we have legends all over the Buddhist world that the Buddha visited. Even where I live, about 25, 30 kilometers from Chiang Mai, in a town called Lampung, there's a very old temple, and the legend goes that the Buddha visited that temple, that he flew there to this spot during his life and spent some time there and left I would have to look up the legend in detail. I don't remember the details of the legend, but the fact is, the belief is that the Buddha visited northern Thailand. So all over the Buddhist world, we have, you know, the belief that the Buddha visited these places. And of course, if Western historians and objective scientific historians consider these stories, they would say, well, we have no proof of this. This is completely legend. This is fabrication. But on the other hand, if we look at it from the eyes, through the eyes of Buddhists, you know, I think you need to remember that we have come very far, too far, from the state of mind of Buddhists throughout the ages, in the sense that we have been very much conditioned by our scientific and historical context, the context in which we've been brought up, the kind of education that we've been given. So now, if we're told the Buddha flew to Chiang Mai while he was teaching in India, we say, oh, well, that must be just a tall tale, you know, that's not possible. But if you look at it from the Buddhist perspective, if the Buddha could go to the heaven of the 33, then why couldn't he go to Chiang Mai? You know, there's nothing to, within the Buddhist context, there's no reason necessarily to discount these traditions. So the fact that the Mahayana Sutras are delivered, some of them in unreal, in quotes, places that you can't point at on the map, it's not necessarily a reason to discount their authenticity. As a matter of fact, some of them were delivered in real places, but to different audiences. For example, the Lotus Sutra is delivered at the Vulture. The Sutra tells us exactly where it was delivered, at the Vulture Peak in Rajagriha. But it wasn't delivered to ordinary people. It was delivered to bodhisattvas and to arhats. So, you know, it's... I'm afraid I've lost track of your question. What was your question? Oh, yeah. No, I mean, these particularly Mahayana texts are not going to have too many passages that coincide exactly with the Theravada texts. But you're asking me, you know, that what I'm doing here is teaching basic doctrines of the Mahayana, so I'm not going to select Mahayana texts that are similar to Theravada texts, because that would not serve my purpose, you know. That doesn't mean that there aren't Mahayana texts that have passages that are very similar to passages in the Theravada texts. There certainly are, I mean, and...
Vice versa,
yes, of course. I mean, there are some differences, and these texts that I have selected are typical and, you know, they express, they are the foremost exponents of the Mahayana tradition. So obviously their purpose is not going to be to replicate ideas and passages that occur in the Theravada text. They are putting forth the Mahayana teaching. That is their primary purpose. So if we wanted to, you know, answer your question, we would have to do a different kind of study and look at the Mahayana texts with a view to finding those texts that have passages and teachings that coincide. That isn't what this course is about. I think it would be very useful for those of you who know Chinese, who can read Chinese, to look at the Chinese collection of the Agamas and to see which texts coincide and to what degree. I think some people are working on this. There's still a lot of work to be done in Buddhist studies. People seem to think that we know all about Buddhism. We don't. We're still studying the texts. Look at this. So many major sutras have not even been translated. So many have not been studied. There's still a lot of work to be done. We're still in the infancy of understanding Buddhism as far as modern scholarship is concerned. Still a lot of work to be done. I find it actually quite disappointing when I go into bookstores and I see books about, you know, and this is not to be sexist, excuse me, the ladies among the audience, you know, but just to give you an example, and there are many examples like this, but American women's views on Buddhism, you know? What is the use of, I mean, that book, okay, it may have some use, but I would much rather see a translation of the Samadhi Raja Sutra, or a translation of the Dashabhumiga Sutra, or a translation of some of the Chinese texts, you know? We have lots of books being published nowadays, baking bread in a Buddhist way, you know, these kinds of books. And what we really need is more work on the literary tradition. So I haven't answered your question exactly, but I can't answer your question because, I mean, I didn't come here prepared to show you passages from Mahayana Sutras that were parallel to Theravada Sutras. I came here to lecture on sutras, to present to you the teachings of sutras that illustrate, that expound the basic doctrines of the Mahayana. So I wouldn't come here with texts that expound the basic doctrines of the Theravada. All right then, so I think that just about does it for this morning, and we'll see you this afternoon.